So, okay, well, I've turned the recorder on, and I'm talking with Jim Grant of Grant's Publishing. And thank you so much for talking to us at the FCIC. I realize I'm asking you to go over some things you've talked about and written about in the past, but just starting at the top, what do you see as the causes of the financial crisis we've just been through?
So, Matt, you have 6 or 8 hours?
let me
try.
Give me the barroom version.
I think that there is an important remote cause in something that might kind of grandiloquently be described as the socialization of risk. For generation upon generation, the tendency has been for we the people to bear the downside and for the lords of finance to gather the upside. And you can track this, what I think is a very, very baleful tendency. You can track it through the development of our laws and customs and usages in finance. Let me give you a couple of examples of how this historical tendency has tracked, in my opinion.
Sure.
Back in the day, from the middle of the 19th century through the middle of the 20th century, the shareholders in nationally chartered banks and in many state banks were on the hook for a capital call in the event their institution failed. This is called a double liability. So you bought, you're a shareholder in a bank went broke, and the sheriff would come looking for you for the portion of your investment that was callable but not yet paid in when you purchase it.
Mm-hmm.
And the vestiges of that are still in evidence in all places. The Federal Reserve, commercial banks that belong to the Fed, are technically on the hook for a capital call in the case the Fed needs it. So this came to an end at the 1935 Banking Act, and then gradually in various state legislations through the early 1950s. But consider the position of the bank stockholder when his liability was not in fact limited to his investment, but was in fact significantly greater than that initial investment in the event of failure. Bank stockholders took a more immediate and constructive interest in their investment, of course, and nothing would be more unwelcome than the knock on the door of the sheriff in the event that you already lost what you put in, didn't want to contribute anymore. So that was the double liability, or it was called a double liability rule in the structure of bank capital. Public bank capitalizations was both a substantive and a symbolic expression of the individual's role in finance. Then, along came deposit insurance, and gradually and by degree, actually not so gradually, suddenly 1935 and gradually until the early 50s, it came to be that the FDIC supplanted those individuals in their position with regard to their bank investments. So that's one sighting,
right.
And there are many, many more. Let me give you one more, and then I'll stop talking. You can talk. But in the day, broker-dealers on Wall Street were general partnerships, so that the GPs were at risk for everything they owned and not merely the interest they held in the likes of J.P. Morgan Company, or later Morgan Stanley, or Goldman Sachs. And the structure of a general partnership, it seemed to me, certainly didn't guarantee solvency, because during the late 60s, many of these Wall Street broker-dealers went by the wayside, and indeed there was fear at the time of a general collapse of Wall Street member firms. But as limited liability corporation form of organization nudged aside the general partnership until at last Goldman Sachs itself went public in, 1998?
Mm-hmm.
The people who run these, who have run these institutions, were more and more insulated from the consequences of their own actions. And you can read the literature on the general partnership form versus the limited liability form, and the scholars will say that these banks had to, the broker deals had to go public because the costs of technology were such they couldn't finance it with retained capital. Be that as it may, I think it's fair to say that you would never have seen Morgan Stanley showing up for work or Bear Stearns showing up in the marketplace in the mid-aughts, levered 40-1, if the top brass were at risk for their homes, their Picassos, and their Labrador Retrievers, as well as their options and their equity in the firm.
Right.
So I think that there's too little emphasis placed upon the gradual but ever so significant shift in American finance away from individual responsibility towards collective responsibility, which sounds in a way kind of pleasing if you are of the view that the state and the collectivity ought to be more important in our public life. But quite apart from political principle, what you have seen, the consequence of this is the big shots on Wall Street get the upside, as I said before, and to the mass of taxpayers, regrettably, increasingly, has gone the downside. So that's end of speech.
Oh, right. Just to follow up on what you said, the transition from partnerships to shareholder-owned companies gives them less incentive because their compensation structure. I mean, it's not.
It gives them the migration from the general partnership form of organization to the limited liability or corporate form has meant most practically that in the event of failure, the liabilities of the firm are not responsibility of the officers.
Right.
And when Lehman was a general partnership, of course, the people sitting around one William Street were. Lehman Brothers was headquartered. They sat in the dining room and talked about business over lunch, and each one of them knew that he was responsible for the actions of others if those actions especially meant the insolvency of Lehman, because its liabilities were the responsibility jointly and severally of the partners. So in the general partnership form of firm, there is an inherent attention to risk management that I think is not necessarily absent from a corporation, but must be inculcated in a corporation because it's not inherent. The fear factor is not inherent. There was a wonderful old guy on Wall Street named Williams who ran the old chemical bank in the last part of the 19th century, and upon his retirement, when he was finally giving interviews explaining what he had done in his career, somebody asked him for the secret of success, and he said, the fear of God.
Right.
And the fear of God is what has been so signally lacking in these financial institutions that were capitalized exclusively for the upside and with precious little thought and attention given to the downside.
Right. Gotcha. Let me ask you about something you've thought a lot about, and that's interest rates. Some people have pointed to Greenspan keeping rates low as one of the causes of the financial crisis, that it helped fuel the housing boom and everything else. Is that an argument that makes sense to you?
Yes. And in particular, I think there's some Fed-generated confusion that is at the bottom of the interest rate question, and that is the fraught issue of deflation. Mm-hmm. So in 2002 and 2003, now Chairman Bernanke and then Chairman Greenspan gave a series of speeches warning us against the perils of broadly falling prices. And these speeches seem to omit any consideration that falling prices might, in fact, be not such a bad thing after all. We Americans seem to spend most of the weekend looking for broadly falling prices. Consumers seem not to mind them. And, in fact, prices fell broadly and persistently, not always to the pleasure of producers, but they fell nonetheless for the last quarter of the 19th century, a time of great technological innovation and geographic expansion of the world's production. In this time of ours, not unlike that, in the accession of a couple hundred million willing new hands into the world's labor force, the spread of digital technology, the adaptation of something like market economies the world over has arguably shifted the world supply curve downward and to the right, so that a given intersection with demand, prices are lower than they might have been 3 or 4 or 5 years before. That possibility was never once even alluded to in these analyses by Messrs. Greenspan and Bernanke. They simply didn't mention it, didn't consider it. So I say that by warning us against and acting to prevent what they styled deflation, they actually precipitated one. Mm-hmm. And by deflation, I mean not merely broadly falling prices, which might, in fact, be called progress. But to me, deflation is a crisis of money and credit, a consequence of which, or a symptom of which, is broadly falling prices when firms unable to finance themselves dump inventory in the market and prices collapse and labor goes unhired and the like. So I say, our line is that by trying to forestall an imagined deflation or ill-considered deflation, these stewards of the dollar have precipitated an actual one.
So given that, where do you have a sense of when they would have been wiser to raise rates?
I don't know. They kept it for 1% for a full year, which then seemed like a very high rate. Now imagine 1%. It's almost alpine.
Right.
I can't give you a good answer as to when they might have, but I think the fundamental error of the Fed that was not so much the number of excessive fiscal quarters at which we were at 1%, but rather the Fed propagated line of argument held that deflation was a clear and present danger, and that the Fed, to forestall this, would print such money as is needed to reinstitute a proper level of inflation. When you say it, it doesn't sound good. I mean, the Fed was actually supposedly in business to prevent dollar debasement. You hear they were saying that they would do everything it took to reinstate what they viewed as a desirable level of dollar debasement. The conduct of the Fed during these years strikes me as mystifying and certainly intellectually unrigorous. They at least ought to have considered the possibility that prices were weak because things were better, not because things were perilous or menacing. But again, to emphasize, I say that it seems to me that by taking such aggressive action against their imagined deflation, they paradoxically brought on the real McCoy.
Right. Now, another culprit for the crisis that's been fingered or at least pointed to is. I'm joined by a couple of colleagues who have come in. This is our research director, Greg Feldberg, is here.
Hello, Greg. Jim Grant here.
Hi.
Yes.
Good to meet you, Jim.
We have
Randall
Dodd is here.
I'm sorry, say the name again?
Randall Dodd.
Hey, Randall, how are you? Jim Grant.
Great to meet you. I've been reading your stuff for so long. I'm delighted.
Well, thank you.
Anyway, one of the other culprits that's been fingered in the past has been, for the crisis, has been complex financial instruments, over-the-counter derivatives. Does that strike you as a cause of the crisis or something?
It's certainly a symptom of the crisis, and I guess one might consider it a cause. The let's see where to begin. Let me tell you the story about how we approach these things. So we have working for us a chemical engineer turned financial analyst. His name is Dan Gertner. And 2006, somebody sends this huge stack of documents having to do with a collateralized debt obligation. And this guy said, who our correspondent said he didn't quite get it. Will we take a look at it? And I presented it to Dan, who around here is the house quant. He can do algebra. So he spent 2 days with it and said he didn't get it, mm-hmm. which led me to think that we really had a good story, which we did. So we kept on probing and asking people how it did work. We finally thought we found out how it was supposed to work. That so many misunderstood, so many failed to penetrate the ever so comforting ratings assigned to these science projects by the agencies that themselves were compromised. Certainly all this was figured importantly into the housing debacle. I'm not sure if it's so much symptom or cause, but it certainly was in the narrative.
Gotcha. And just going back to the Fed, what about the Fed's regulatory role? I mean, we talked about interest rates, but they're obviously a big factor in banking regulation and systemic questions.
Yes. The Fed's regulatory role is one I've never paid much attention to. I always thought, for example, now there's a great hue and cry for the Fed to insert itself more aggressively into the protection of consumers, which seems to me it might begin to do by giving savers an interest rate somewhat greater than zero. But so it has not, it apparently will not for a while. The Fed did not distinguish itself in seeing any of this. So I'm stammering for something constructive,
sure.
Say, and not finding it. I mean, parenthetically, I guess I say in a tone of some pique that I would once in my life like to live long enough to invest in an institution that, like the Fed, can emerge from a crisis which it did not anticipate, which it actually happened to precipitate, and yet emerge from it even stronger and with greater prestige and power. That's what I want to invest in my life as a private investor. I'm not sure it's going to happen.
I hear it. Feel free.
So one of the things that our commissioners have been asking about is canaries in the coal mine, just warning signals that should have been perceived at some point. And I guess I'd be interested in what your view are on that.
Yes, this speaks, of course, to the idea of there being some systemic watchdog. As these thoughts occur to me, let me produce them. One is the paradox of the difficulty of he or she who would blow a whistle or sound a tweet and be consistent with the image of a canary. That person is likely to be one of skeptical turn of mind, something of an outsider. And he or she is likely to have tweeted prematurely many times before the ideal time to have sounded the alarm. So the Cassandra is likely always to have been vigilant too early, because that is his or her destiny in life, seemingly to be on the outside looking in and to see things others don't, and to be irritated at some level about being on the outside looking in. So that is about the nature of the bearish skeptical observer. I happen to be in this line of work and can vouch for some of these things. But there were, of course, and not so much in retrospect, but in actual real time, there were countless signs and portents of trouble ahead. And where to begin? In the area of, for example, corporate finance, the investment bankers would price junk bonds at most extraordinarily cheap levels with the most extraordinary lax covenants. And, and the investment bankers would not believe what they were getting away with, and they would say so. I mean, they would leave these meetings and the closing of deals, and they would be thunderstruck at what the market was allowing, and yet the market would turn around the next deal and give them more. So when people talk about the housing crisis, there's a correct citing. There was a crisis in the pricing and mispricing of mortgage securities and in the construct of mortgage securities, but it seems to me that the crisis was very broadly one of the abuse and mispricing of debt in almost all of its forms. And this naturally gets back to the question of the Fed and even the nature of the dollar. The book I sent, you can kind of look there and get a. I don't recite what the timeline, but there's a. You can see how the envelope was pushed and pushed until it finally exploded in mortgage-backed securities and CDOs and some of the more exotic variations on the theme of CDO and of course in leveraged corporate credit and in leveraged loans, that is the senior claims on leveraged companies. But throughout the length and breadth of the capital markets, the ridiculous gave way to the absurd, but everyone was in on it, and everyone was making money, and those who had an interest in what Justice Brandeis called the situation had run out of adjectives long before the crisis reached its peak.
So when did those behaviors start to become apparent? How early would you say?
Oh, can the witness refresh his memory? Let me reach for one book. This will take about 15 seconds. Hang on. We wrote a piece. I think it's, is it that book? It's called Over the Cliff with Morgan Stanley. Anyway, I'm going to.
Adam, can you print out a piece called Over the Cliff with Morgan Stanley?
I think that's 2006. And I thought at the time that Morgan Stanley was the epitome of what was going wrong, and it seemed one-stop shopping for every financial excess of the age. I'll tell you in a second, but it's almost certainly by 2006. It was buying subprime mortgage originators at very fancy multiples of book value, as that fad and mania was in fact peaking or had peaked. It was into leveraged corporate finance in a big way. It was doing infrastructure finance. It was doing private equity. Every fancy and faddish thing at the time, it was doing on leverage of up to 40 times, and it was extraordinary. But it passed for normal. Many minutes ago, somebody asked for a list of a sampler of excesses or of canaries that I think that if you, I'll send you this piece on Morgan Stanley. But in that one firm, it seems to me, was the cycle on display.
So is this an issue of just risk management within a firm, or is it inappropriate incentives for the firm upside and down?
See that last question again.
Is this an issue of just poor risk management, or did the company, did the management just have the wrong incentives?
Well, I think both. Before you came in, I was reflecting on the consequences of Wall Street's migration over the years from the general partnership form of organization to the limited liability one, and I contended that. that Morgan Stanley, had it remained a partnership, first of all, would not have been any so as large as it was, had a $1 trillion balance sheet under John Mack. It could not have gained that size. It could not have gained the leverage that it produced because the general partners were at risk jointly and severally for the liabilities of the firm. And never mind sleeping at night, they would have gone stark raving mad during broad daylight had they had that risk. So the modern structure of the broker-dealer was a facilitator of the very of these extraordinary balance sheets and these extraordinary risk profiles that these firms managed to generate since the past 15 years. Maybe some bright corporation lawyer out there could think of a way of joining the best features of limited liability with partnership. Perhaps at some level the control officers of a firm ought to be personally liable at some level. We wrote a piece of what we had at one of our conferences. We had a couple of speakers from Brazil. They're Brazilian hedge fund guys, and they said, "Did you know that during the drama of 2008, that they sent they were living in London, working in London. They sent their cash and securities back to Brazilian banks, as did others they knew, because in Brazil the controlling stockholders and board of a banking institution are personally at risk for the entire net worth in the event of insolvency for as long as the court proceedings take to investigate the cause and to pick through the remains of the estate and to settle all the final questions of who owes what to whom." And as he somewhat dryly put it, sometimes these proceedings can go on. Apparently, in one case, it went on for 20 years. So there is a real incentive for the people who are most in the way of gaining by institution success to concentrate not least on the possibility of the institution's failure. And I think that's, to repeat my sermonette of earlier, I think that's what is, that's an important remote cause of our troubles, is the gradual the capitalists have worked themselves in a position where they get the upside and the rest of us share with them and mainly bear the downside.
Let me ask you a question, if I might. We had a problem that was analogous in some ways in the 1970s with petrodollars, and we had a whole bunch of banks that ended up taking losses on sovereign credits, Poland, Mexico, that were in excess of their capital, and the regulators generously forbore, and all the institutions were happy. That was in an earlier world before we had a number of the incentives we have today. Any thoughts about that? In other words, we've had these problems in a variety of guises back over time.
Well, we've had it for at least 200. We've had it for as long as banks have been open for business. The nature of a leveraged financial institution is a very precarious nature indeed. There is, I think that there is no system guaranteed to. Obviously, there's no system that saves human beings from the weaknesses of the flesh and of the mind that money seems to induce. Money makes us all crazy, especially with a lot of commas and zeros after the first integer. But I think that we have unconsciously, but quite perniciously, evolved a system that somehow. Features the worst of a collective approach to management of financial affairs and of a private one. Never before in our history have we had the following features in our financial lives all at once: a fiat currency and a central bank that, to amplify a little bit on that, central bank that has on which there is no anchor, there's no limit on what the Fed can do. It's all a matter of the discretion of the Open Market Committee, the Board of Governors. It's an extraordinary thing. But that's a new feature since 1971. New as well as the crisis in which Wall Street was unanchored by the salutary fear of personal ruin on the part of the general partners of these brokerage firms. Now they're all corporate officers and not partners. And a variation on that is the Fed's increasing intrusiveness and micromanagement of finance. You know, it's not enough that they fix a rate. What the Fed does for a living is price fix. But beyond that, they are out giving speeches, steering the economy, and trying to mitigate, forestall, and otherwise dampen cycles. Well, it seems to me that the purpose of a cycle is to reinstill a constructive and salutary fear of the downside. And, you know, the economists talk about what they are pleased to call the great moderation, and the central bankers rather preen themselves on the lack of volatility in cycles from the mid-1980s, which was the consequence, they thought, of their increasingly deft and dexterous management of monetary affairs and interest rates. But consider the unintended consequence of that, which is leverage unimagined, let alone unseen, and I think at any time. I don't know that any brokerage firm, any bulge bracket firm, was ever levered 4-to-1 in any other cycle. So, you know, massive leverage, fine-tuning by the Fed, all manner of assurances that there would not be anything resembling a crack-up of, you know, any snow of yesteryear. The latitude given to the Fed by the institution of pure paper money, you know, no collateral behind a dollar, they can make as many as they want. I think all these things kind of came together in the aughts to produce what we have seen, which is like this immense mushroom cloud.
What were some of the drivers of the massive leverage?
I think maybe let me propose that willful ignorance, I think, was the great theme of our cycle of leverage. It was a willful ignorance of the nature of the securities that were warranted AAA, but which a little bit of probing showed were anything but. That was one source. Another source was the willful ignorance of history and of cycles, the drinking of the Fed brewed Kool-Aid that we had somehow lived, that we had put the age of cycles behind us, and that the great moderation was to be perpetual, I guess I'm running out of subheads for the willful ignorance, but I'm going to repeat myself, and you'll now be itching to hang up the phone. But I think that the temptation to underestimate risk in the structure of a limited liability corporation was almost irresistible.
Do you put any weight on the regulators or the Congress in terms of permitting such high leverage?
Yes, my politics are so deeply libertarian that I never have paid much attention to the role that ought to have been or might have been played by the regulators. That's something we have paid almost next to no attention to here. But certainly, if that was part of the Fed's remit, and it was, the Fed failed miserably at monitoring leverage and streaming. These firms made no secret of how they were structured. They published balance sheets quarterly. The Fed publishes weekly. Everyone knew how great the leverage was, you heard precious little of it in these speeches by the governors of the Fed. Why didn't, you know, they're so so eager to come out and sidewalk superintend our economic and financial lives? How about a remark or two on what was happening in Wall Street?
So there have been some papers recently about the shadow banking system and how this this was a kind of a more fragile way to do maturity transformation and to do credit intermediation, which had traditionally been banking activities. What do you think of those arguments and that telling of history?
Important, but we wrote almost nothing about it. I guess that was one of our blind spots, so I'll pass on the question. But certainly the so much, that was a stammer on to no effect. I will stop there and say it's a good question for somebody else.
Okay.
Well, certainly the rating agencies don't seem to have distinguished themselves in this.
Nope, they did not.
But, do you see them as just a symptom of the crisis or more of a cause?
I wonder if the all-purpose phrase willful ignorance might not apply here as well. The rating agencies are in business to make money, and certainly when Moody's became a stock, the business of topping earnings per share with the great encouragement of no other than Warren Buffett was front and center at that firm. I think there was a dereliction of duty. I think that, what about the responsibility of all these chartered financial CFA, chartered financial analysts to look underneath the hood of these structures? It wasn't so hard. It was not so hard to see that what was represented to be a AAA was in fact anything but. It was these structures were based upon the very convenient and utterly arbitrary assumption that there would be no coast-to-coast bear market in house prices, because there had been none in the historical reckoning of the people who were in charge of making money by rating them. I mean, it was an extraordinarily lame intellectual effort, but CFAs do, turns out, tens of thousands of people who are warranted to be independent students of finance and security analysis. And how about a little bit of homework? I mean, I don't know of any serious bond analyst who says that because Moody's says that's what is. But the agencies have always been bureaucratic. They have never been in the business of imagining the next thing. They have never been in the business of doing anything except expressing an opinion on the here and now and on kind of what is. And so, I did a bad job, but it seems to me that the people who were the guys who are making $150,000 a year did a very bad job. The guys who are making $10 million a year did a proportionally worse job and not asking more.
All right, I want to play into your libertarian side for a minute. One of the statements in the whole crisis that has been most striking to me has been Alan Greenspan's statement that what surprised him most was the inability of institutions and banks in particular to protect the best interests of the owners and the company. What lessons, clearly the regulators didn't work out very well, but what lessons do we derive from the inability of institutions to protect their own best interests, given that that's what our market system depends on?
Well, I think Alan Greenspan was not distinguishing properly between the roles of principals and agents. Yes, a number of the fallen executives at our once mighty financial institutions were themselves important owners. Jimmy Kane was a not insubstantial owner of the equity of Bear Stearns, and he was playing bridge. But for the most part, since the dawn, earlier in the call I was reflecting on our gradual migration away from the system of owner responsibility to one of collective responsibility. And what Alan Greenspan neglected to say was, until for a great part of the financial history of this country, an owner of a bank equity was at risk of a capital call in the event of an insolvency of that organization. All that ended.
Happened, if I can interrupt for a minute, with the double liability of bank shareholders? Just about the time an institution was going down, it's amazing how many custodians owned a huge amount of bank stock.
Right. To be sure, but there's a paper by Macy and Miller that points out that on the whole, this system, as obviously imperfect as it was, and you can imagine just how welcome was the call for capital on the part of the failed institution or its stewards, that the sums recovered from the shareholders, it says here, I'm looking at it right now, significantly benefited depositors and other bank creditors and undoubtedly did much to enhance public confidence in the banking system, despite the fact that almost all bank deposits were uninsured. So this is from a law review piece a couple of years ago.
Can you give us the site? That's great.
Sure. I can email you this. We had it on our website for time.
Thanks.
But I think that that perhaps Mr. Greenspan neglected to make helpful distinctions and definitions, and the people who ran these institutions into the ditch were all too infrequently real owners. It seems to me they were all too often employees. To be sure, very well-paid employees, but they were not the owners. And the owners themselves were functionally and institutionally distant from from what they did own. So it's I think that Greenspan spoke without due consideration.
Is this a subject you've written articles about?
On the double liability?
Yeah.
Yes, but mostly mostly citing this very good piece, which I'll send you.
Thank you.
I can send you what we have done.
I think Tom might know more about it than me. But so, could you just state the thesis? Kind of, how did it work, and when was that? When were those rules changed?
It was this business was the double liability was a feature of our banking. Organization for about 75 years between the Civil War and the Depression.
Yeah.
And so the typically a shareholder in a bank was responsible for only not only what he or she paid for the stock, but also for a portion of the bank's debts after the insolvency. So the receiver after the crack-up would determine the extent of the insolvency and then dun the shareholders for the amount up to and including the par value of the stock. And that's when you see the old par value. That's what that meant. That's what that was about. And so this was actively enforced, and it was. If you go back now and you read some of the memoirs of people who lived in that time, they'll talk about how a guy had been rich, but he was a stockholder of a bank that failed, and they lost everything in the failure. So this was in place, as I say, from the Civil War to the Great Depression, but they were and into the 50s in some states where it was a law.
So they have records of stock prices selling below zero?
Well, the stock would go to zero, and I guess the...
In order to transfer that liability, you'd probably take less than zero for the stock.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if anyone has any records.
Well, they were worried about transfers at that point because they were worried they'd transfer them to the custodian of the bank. I mean, that's the problem, that you needed to fix the ownership. But it's interesting that it went out what, with deposit insurance? Was that the trade?
Yes, it went out with deposit insurance, effectively. It literally went out with the Banking Act of 1935, but the deposit insurance was so what you find is, for example, there was a our office grants is in our offices are in 2 Wall Street. 2 Wall Street was the headquarters of the First National Bank of New York, which was run by George F. Baker, who was a great banking entrepreneur of the last half of the 19th century, indeed into the first couple of decades of the 20th. And Baker's and his franchise was safety. The First National Bank was known to be safer than safe, but he was also quite imaginative. And and I've written about this from the original documents. But the bank examiners were kind of mystified as to the complexity of his affairs, but also in awe of the margin of safety that he built into his institution. And that, to me, is the model from which we have strayed, and which Alan Greenspan, who has a publicly confessed ignorance of financial history, neglected to mention. I'm not sure how one goes about restoring, putting capitalism back into capital, but it would be a nice project for somebody some weekend.
Have you looked at the role of boards of directors in mitigating risk taken in the current crisis?
I have not.
Okay.
I need to ask a totally different question, if I may. First of all, thank you. I wrote a book in 1991 called The State of Risk, Will Government-Sponsored Enterprises Be the Next Financial Crisis? And you wrote a very fine blurb for the back of the book.
You were at AEI, were you not?
Yeah.
Well, that's a terrific book.
Thank you.
It is a terrific book.
Well, it's available on Amazon for $2. That said, is the stepping off point. What do you think about the role of the GSEs in the current crisis?
Oh, I mean, worse than scandalous. I think what everybody else thinks, but maybe because I've read your book with a greater and more intense sense of disgust.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not sure what I should say. I think that I will send you, by the way, if you would like, I'll send you a very interesting colloquy between Chairman Bernanke and New Jersey Congressman during the Humphrey Hawkins hearings about the Fed's holdings of Fannie and Freddie debentures.
Yeah.
So the question is, so Chairman, you own two-thirds of the balance sheet is now in bankruptcy. What do they call it? Not bankruptcy. It's in
conservatorship.
Conservatorship, right? And the chairman is rather at a loss for words, and the congressman persists, and he says, "Well, am I correct, Mr. Chairman, saying that that the government is guaranteeing these liabilities only through next year?" Well, yes. So, is it not the case that the solvency of the Federal Reserve System really is a question that's open at the moment, and like that? So, not the least of the ironies of the GSEs now is that their conservatorship is really is now hostage to the Federal Reserve solvency is hostage. Along with the future of these agencies in the hands of Congress. I mean, what happens if some libertarian impulse sweeps Congress and they decide to let the GSEs go? Well, we'd hear from certainly the People's National Bank, People's Bank of China, and the BOJ and others, but certainly we'd also hear from the mandarins of the Fed because their net worth would vanish.
Thank you.
Another quote that I noticed from Greenspan's actually was from the paper he wrote for Brookings on the crisis was that these securities, and I guess he was talking about some CDOs, were too complex for any investor to understand.
Nuts.
Which raises the question: should they never have existed, or should they have been? Would it have been possible to better explain them, or is transparency the answer?
Well. You often hear it said, and I dare say you guys have heard this said by about a million witnesses, but nobody could have seen. In the book that I sent you, thanks to the, as I say, our quant on the staff, our BS in chemical engineering, we managed to figure some of these things out, and what you figure out when you look at them is that there is no margin of safety, as the Graham and Dodd tribe puts things. There's no, they were priced for a perfect outcome. They were just poor investments, and they certainly were not AAA. And they were, in a sense, unanalyzable because some of them had hundreds of thousands of pages of documentation. But when something is unanalyzable, what that means is that whatever else it might be, it is not without risk. And they were priced, these things were collectively, as if they were treasury bills, but with one basis point more return. So I don't know. I think it's disingenuous, Mr. Greenspan, to insist that they were unanalyzable. They were and they were not.
So it's fair to simply blame investors because they should have known better.
Fair to blame investors?
Yeah.
Yes, it is fair to blame professional investors because that's why they were making their $2.8 million a year for a bonus. Absolutely.
Now, what about the when it comes to this system that we had in place to kind of to spread the risk of mortgage securities among many different actors? What do you think of the role of the monoline insurance companies? And did they play an important role? Obviously, they they took on more than they could chew, but was their presence important for the system to exist?
I think their presence was another source of false security for people who, for whatever reason, didn't do their jobs. But the bottom line insurance companies, not content with insuring securities that never defaulted, had to get into the business of insuring things that would certainly default. And MBIA is a great case. Actually, I wrote a book on this. One of the guys who fought the MBI battle on was a short seller. I forgot what his name is. But if you'd like, I can get that. Things I'll send you, I can tell you that citation's new book. But
I think that's Confidence Game, I think, is the book?
Yes, yep, mm-hmm. Yeah. And now, you know, MBIA is, to add insult to injury, it's with the connivance and the blessing of the New York State Insurance Department, it has separated itself between the municipal bond division, which is clean, and the MBS division, which is, shall we say, unclean. And the debt holders got all of the unclean part of it. So with the MBI, you thought it couldn't get worse. It has. Mm-hmm.
It's implicit resolution authority to divide up the bank, push down losses into the bondholders, right?
Yeah.
And protect the municipalities that have been paying these guys premiums for guaranteeing their debt.
Right.
Which, you know, is maybe the bondholders didn't deserve that much discipline, but on the other hand, they didn't, they got some market discipline there.
Well, they got no compensation for that part of the business that was taken away. So I don't think it was exactly a contractual thing. It was more like a
fairness doesn't jump to mind.
Yeah.
I guess another theme that we've been asked to look into is too big to fail, and I guess there's a lot of ways to think about that. But one is the question whether the idea that you're going to be bailed out by the government might make you take more risks, and it might make investors more willing to buy your securities.
Well said. I'm not sure I could add to that except to encourage you along those lines. The best corporate biography of a bank is that of Citibank, and it's written by the first author is named Cleveland, and the second author is named Huertas, Huertas, and it's Citibank 1812-1970, and in the chronology you see this the bank changing and the bank and Citi kind of personifying in its corporate identity the migration of our financial arrangements from a system of individual and capitalist risk-taking to one of collective risk-bearing. Capital still get the upside, of course, but we the people get the downside. And the year 1812 is, to me, very, very evocative because that was a decade in which, let's see, so Citibank was 1812 and Brown Brothers Harriman was 18. So these two institutions founded in that decade of the 19th century, one has remained a general partnership, and the other, of course, not, and I guess in the way the city could. But Brown Brothers is the institution that came through this without ever getting into the papers. And it might be interesting to talk to one of those guys and ask them what they did and what they didn't do.
Yep.
That the others did and the others did so much of.
One of the perks of this commission is that we are able to subpoena documents and persons and have no jurisdictional boundaries. So given that, are there things you would want to know about this crisis that you don't know? And that you think we should know?
Let me think about that. It's a delicious thought. I think in fact Matt might have mentioned that when we spoke late last week, and I've not given enough. That's a very precious invitation, and I will try to do it justice and send you an email.
Okay.
Without thinking about subpoenas, is there anybody at Brown Brothers you might recommend we call?
The senior GP is a guy, Digger Donahue, I think. Digger is his I think that's not the name his mother gave him, but that's what they call him over there.
Okay.
So I was at a meeting I'm not sure I was there, but it was kind of a meeting of the great and the good, and they were talking about the crisis, and one of the eminences present was himself a senior government official who was also a senior executive at a firm called Goldman Sachs, and I floated this E-Day fix I have about partnerships and about limited liability and about the change in the so-called risk culture on Wall Street since these changes have taken place in the form of our broker-dealers and the Wall Street member firms, New York Stock Exchange member firms. And this fellow said, yes, said, we could never have become as big as we are if we had remained a general partnership. And I thought to myself, aha, yes, that might have been helpful.
Mm-hmm.
The sheer immensity of these operations, was it quite necessary for Morgan Stanley to have I guess Lehman too had a better part of $1 trillion of footings. Why? And this gets wrapped in with too big to fail, of course, and with the... with the notion that the Fed will be there with a mop and a pail come a real crisis. Not that there would be a real crisis, the Fed being so nimble at manipulating interest rates. So I think that somehow in the mind of Wall Street, there came to be this kind of institutional complacency. It was like a couple of guys in a rowboat out fishing. And they were out for the day, and they loaded the boat to the gunwales with cases of beer because they knew that never on this pristine, crystal-clear lake was there anything like a zephyr, let alone a wave. It was all, to be clear, and perfect and serene. And wouldn't you know it, just a little tiny wave comes up, and the boat sinks along with their beer and their fishing tackle. And Wall Street, it seems to me, was a little bit in that position. As the odds wore on, it wasn't as if there had not been a previous period of stress with the busting of the high-tech bubble and the like. But somehow, the management of the Fed had inculcated the idea that under its stewardship, there really would be nothing like an old-time crisis, and there would be the most deft intervention to forestall anything truly dangerous. Ergo, you know, low interest rates, low volatility, and massive leverage.
Well, let's go to your metaphor for a second. Does that basically say that something with a much smaller magnitude than the current crisis would have sunk a whole bunch of firms?
Yes, yeah, I think so.
That's great.
When you're leveraged 30 or 40 to 1, think of how little it takes.
That's exactly right. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Jim. I really appreciate your...
You're entirely welcome. Can somebody send me an email so I can send you back what I have to offer?
Sure. I've got your email. I'll send it to you.
Great. I'll be right back to you with what I can send you.
Okay.
Nice to talk to you all.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Okay. Bye.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Great. I can hardly wait for the Macy article because they did such arbitrage on that double liability.